It's just about time for us to get started with our class this evening. Thank you for being here, and please open in your Bibles to Judges chapter 16. That's where our study will pick up in just a moment. Today, excitingly, we're in the new year. We're planning to cover chapter 16 and 17. Next week, we'll plan to cover chapter 18 and chapter 19, part of chapter 19. Second to last class will be the end of chapter 19 and chapter 20, and then there's a short chapter at the end of Judges, which is chapter 21. So our plan for the last class is to spend less than half the class talking about that chapter, and then have some concluding comments about the book of Judges. So this is exciting. We're in the last month of the class and winding it down. You may remember that last week in our class, we continued talking about Samson. He's taking up three of our classes, and the judge that is most discussed in the book of Judges, taking up four chapters. And mainly it was his efforts against the Philistines in chapters 14 and 15 that we discussed last week. And so his attempt to marry the Philistine woman and then the escalating violence that ensued. And then Samson defeating the Philistines in verse 15. And that conflict with the Philistines will just continue on into chapter 16. And it's going to culminate in Samson's demise at the end of chapter 16. So tonight, it's also exciting because we're finishing part two of the book of Judges, which you'll recall is the bulk of the book of Judges, describing the various judges, about 12 of them, depending on how you count. And we're going to transition to the last part, part three of the book of Judges, which is the last five chapters. And while the first two chapters discuss the origins or roots of Israel's apostasy, the middle chapters, talking about the judges specifically, describe the downward spiral of Israel's apostasy. And then, as we've alluded to before, the end of the book is really bleak, and it's going to describe the depths to which Israel sank in their apostasy against the Lord. So that's what we're going to begin talking about tonight. But before that, we're going to wrap up talking about Samson in chapter 16. So Samson now travels to Gaza, which is located here. You'll remember that it's one of the five cities, major Philistine cities, one of the five cities in the Philistine Pentapolis, the others being Gath, Ekron, Ashdod, and Ashkelon. You'll remember that Ashkelon was where he stole the 30 pieces of clothes to take back and honor the vow that he had made before his wedding. And most of the events in chapter 16 tonight are going to take place in Gaza. We'll come back to that slide in just a moment. So he travels there and meets up with, to have sex with, a prostitute. The Hebrew there is that he approached her. It's an idiom euphemistic for sexual relations. And again, we're seeing in Samson him being driven by lust and a lack of self-control. The Philistines in Gaza become aware of Samson's presence in the city, and so they set an ambush at the city gate. There they quietly lay an ambush all night and plan to kill him at first light in the morning. However, Samson gets up in the middle of the night and takes the entire city gate out of its foundation, puts it on his shoulders, and carries it to the top of the hill that is in front of Hebron. Okay, so here's Gaza. There's Hebron, okay? So we don't know exactly how much the gates would have weighed to the city, but assuming, based on evidence they found of gates during this time, it may have been about 10 feet by 10 feet high versus width, and about 18 inches thick, and if it was made of cedar, the gates would have been about 5,000 pounds. So Samson's carrying potentially 2.5 tons from Gaza to Hebron, and that trip, as the crow flies, is about 38 miles. But there's a 3,200-foot, not incline, but gain in elevation from Gaza, which is near the coast, to Hebron. So I think we can all agree this is a superhuman feat that he accomplishes. But how does that leave Gaza? That leaves Gaza without one of the main forms of defense that they had to protect their city. And so I think at this time now, based on their previous interactions with Samson, the Philistines are realizing that they will be unable to subdue Samson with brute force or strength, which is why they're going to employ a different method in the rest of the verses in chapter 16. That brings us to verse 4. After this episode in Gaza, we come to find out that Samson falls in love with a woman in the valley of Sorek. And let me go back just a bit to our map here. because the Valley of Sorek is here, which is near his hometown of Zora, okay? So Delilah, who is the only woman named in Samson's story, is living in this valley, and that's where he meets her and falls in love with her. As I said, she's the only woman named in Samson's story, and her name comes from the root verb delal, meaning to dangle or to hang, perhaps a reference to loose hair. It can either mean that, as in like dangling curls, or some have said her name is associated with a Semitic root for coquettish gesture, meaning being flirtatious, or even to the Hebrew term for night, suggesting her dark role. We don't know exactly, again, what her name meant, but it's noteworthy that the text says Samson loved Delilah, but according to the text, that feeling, as far as we know, was not reciprocated. In other words, Delilah loving Samson. Also doesn't say that they were married. However, his sleeping in her house strongly implies a sexual relationship. Does the text say what Delilah's nationality was? It doesn't. So we don't know for a fact that she was a Philistine. It's likely that she was, but it's possible that she was an Israelite. I can't prove it one way or another. Remember, the Philistines and the Israelites were close during this time. Remember that Samson wanted to marry an Israelite in the previous chapter. So based on Samson's relationship with Delilah, him loving her, the Philistine lords approach her with an offer. They promise her that if she would trick Samson into divulging the secret to his strength, they would each give her 1,100 pieces of silver. This text doesn't say how many Philistine lords there were, but other Old Testament passages identify five Philistine lords, which correspond to the five cities that I mentioned on the previous slide. So that totals about 5,500 pieces of silver if she was able to reveal to them the secret of Samson's strength. The survival wage for a household during this period was 22 shekels per year. So from this perspective, the reward offered to Delilah was enough to provide a living for 250 years. So there's her motivation. We don't know that she loves Samson. She's using him as a means to an end, and that is for a big payday, at least. That's at least what the text says. We can learn something from her character here by what motivates her, which is money. The Philistines' motivation, on the other hand, is to subdue and to humiliate Samson. So she has this deal and very brazenly and frankly asks Samson how he can be subdued. And Samson tells her how many lies in sequence. You remember? How many times did they go back and forth in the course of the text before the truth was revealed? Three times, that's right. So on the fourth time is when he tells her the truth because she nagged him to death. But the three times before, he told her lies. So in the first lie, he said he would be weakened and be like any other man if he was bound with seven fresh bowstrings. So these bowstrings would have been made from the tendon of an animal and used for the string of a bow. Fresh bowstrings would have been weaker and more flexible than fully dried ones, implying, at least according to one commentator that I read, that Samson was playing with Delilah, trying to trick her into thinking there was something mysterious or magical in the effect that a fresh bowstring would have. So Delilah, with the help of the Philistine lords, binds Samson with these bowstrings. Soldiers of the Philistines wait in ambush in an inner room of Delilah's house, presumably, and Delilah shouts for the first time, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." On this occasion and for the next two times, Samson escapes from his bonds, and it's not stated, but presumably slaughters his would-be captors. And so on this occasion, the secret of his strength was unknown. And if we haven't seen it yet, isn't Samson's pride obvious in these interactions? His hubris and ego, acting like he's untouchable, that he can lie, at least initially, and not disclose the secret, but make her think that he's disclosed the secret, flirting with and engaging in sin, being associated with Delilah. This story, as you well know, does not end well for Samson. And that same kind of attitude, pride, egotistical, thinking we're untouchable, flirting with sin, would not end well for us either. Dropping down now to verse 10, Delilah bemoans her treatment. Remember, she's pulling on Samson's heartstrings. He loves her, and so she knows the buttons to push. She tells Samson he'd mocked her and lied to her, which he had done, and again requests to know how he might be subdued. For the second time, Samson lies, this time saying that if he was bound with new ropes, he could be overcome. That was the same method, by the way, that his fellow Israelites used to bind him when they were going to hand him over to the Philistines in the previous chapter, with new ropes. So she does. She binds Samson with these new ropes and again sets an ambush. Samson snaps the new ropes off his arms like thread. So again, these new ropes were ones used for rigging, strong enough for pulling a cart with cattle. That's seen in a verse like Isaiah chapter 5 and verse 18. Not worn from use, so unlike the fresh bowstrings, these would have been very strong in terms of bonds, but with his superhuman strength that God gave him, he was able to burst those bonds. Again, Delilah accuses Samson of deceiving and lying to her and asks for a third time how he could be bound. So how does he tell her for the third time that he can be subdued? Why?
Tear in a loom, and when it got stuck, he wouldn't be strong anymore.
Yeah, that's right. So a loom they would have used to make fabrics. Into the loom, his braids would go, secured with a pin, he could be subdued. Just imagine Delilah having been deceived twice and now finally thinking, okay, well, he's told me the truth now. And by the way, doesn't this last third description of how he could be subdued get dangerously close to the truth? Now he's talking about his hair, which is, in fact, the last nail in the coffin, so to speak, of how he had maintained his Nazirite status before God, that he's going to get subdued in a couple of verses. So Delilah does this while he slept, and for a third time, he's able to escape the Philistine trap. That brings us down to verse 15, so I want to pause here and see what questions or comments y'all have so far in the reading.
Yes. Interesting that he doesn't give her the answer that we know was the right answer. But unless it's just not recorded, he had never found out whether cutting his hair would actually take away his strength. So he had faith in that promise. Which is, you know, he didn't make wise choices with that knowledge, but he did have a hesitancy to disclose that.
Yeah. Good point.
Now, whether this next time, how he felt about that.
Right, even in when he says it to her in verse 17, a razor has never come upon my head, for I have been a Nazirite to God from my mother's womb. So there, one of the few times, if not the only time, that Samson references God impacting his life. So good point. Thank you. What else? Angel?
Learning about sin and how sometimes we can be fooled into thinking that, you know, it's that... thinking that reality is not the way it is. And the sad part about it is she gave him plenty of reason for him to doubt her, and he dismissed all of it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. There were lots of red flags in this relationship that he ignored. And just like for us, there are lots of red flags that we can ignore and end up in trouble because of that. Mark?
Which was, why did they think that there was... something that could be done to limit his strength. I mean, he could have just said, this is a blessing from God, and left it at that.
Yeah, that is a good point. I know that they were under the impression that something could be done to weaken him. So maybe some part of the secret had gotten out before. But. All right. So now Delilah really ramps it up. She says to Samson, how can you say I love you when your heart is not with me? Which, by the way, is very similar to what his wife said back on the issue of the riddle a couple of chapters ago. She notes he had lied to her three times by not telling her what made him so strong, and the NET translates verse 16 this way. She nagged him every day and pressured him until he was sick to death of it. Remember what was in it for her, a big payday. So she wears Samson down, and he tells her about his Nazirite status before God, telling her that if his head were shaved, he would become weak and be like any other man. So this photo here is a flint blade, which would have been used for a variety of purposes, to include cutting one's hair. A well-made flint blade could be even sharper than a bronze razor. There's a term, Cananean blade, referring to a long, wide blade made of stone or flint. Although a few metal razors from this period have been discovered, flint blades were cheaper, sharper, and easier to acquire at this time. As another example, there were flint blades used by Joshua for circumcision in Joshua chapter 5 and verse 2. So, you know, obviously we don't know that this was used, what was used, but I think in a little bit there's a, yeah. So in this painting by Rembrandt, he has some scissors. So I don't think that's historically accurate. It was probably more like this. So it wasn't Samson's long hair that gave him his strength. It wasn't refraining from grapes or not touching a corpse. God was the source of Samson's strength, and in finally forsaking his dedicated status before the Lord by divulging this secret and allowing his head to be shorn, God disempowers Samson and allows him to be subdued. Delilah realizes this. You know, you can tell with someone you know when they're finally telling you the truth. And that's what the text says in verse 18. When Delilah saw that he had told her all his heart, she tells the Philistine lords how to do it. And while Samson slept, a man comes and shaves his hair. The ESV translates verse 19 this way. Then she began to torment him, which probably means instead of referring to some specific insulting action on Delilah's part, this was just that she, through the devious actions just described, began the process of Samson's humiliation, which culminates in the following verses. Also that phrase, she made him go to sleep on her lap or on her knee, could be a euphemism for sexual intercourse as well. So the means that she may have employed to get him to go to sleep, and then the individual coming in, the man coming in and shaving his hair. So this ambush scene unfolds for the fourth time. And what does Samson think when he's awoken from his sleep? Thinks, well, this will be just like the other three times. I'll break loose from my bonds. But when he awakes from his slumber, he did not know that the Lord had left him. The Philistines bind Samson with bronze chains, gouge out his eyes, and transport him to Gaza. So that's what this painting depicts here, is the blinding of Samson. You probably had similar thoughts to this in reading this account, but it's hard not to think about how Samson doesn't realize how much danger he's putting himself in, both physically and spiritually. He was unable to see how dangerous this woman was to him, more than a young lion or a group of Philistine soldiers had been before that he was able to successfully conquer. But I think there's an application for us, as Angel alluded to before, that we can be similarly blinded by emotion and desire in our lives and therefore unable to see the perilous situation we find ourselves in. It may not be for Samson like a romantic relationship, which it could be. There are many people who are lured into sin by a romantic partner. Maybe some other vice or temptation. Whatever it is, this account emphasizes the importance of, one, being rooted in God's word, which obviously did not have much import to Samson based on his actions and words, and also the importance of being surrounded by faithful brothers and sisters to avoid such a fate. So that when they see us in a dangerous situation, like if Samson had had a loving brother or a loving family member aware of his relationship with Delilah, and maybe it did happen, we just don't know it, but they could have tried to snatch him out of the fire, of that terrible situation that he found himself in. On the other end of that, we need to have the courage to snatch others out of the fire when we see them in a dangerous situation like Samson was. Sometimes, regrettably, people are blinded to the spiritual dangers that they're in their life based on the choices that they make, and other people in their lives see it and don't say anything or don't say much about it. And that's about as opposite to love as there can be, to let someone continue in a perilous situation like Samson was and not do what we can to rescue them from it. It's ironic that Samson's greatest act of deliverance, which we haven't talked about yet, will come after he is finally blind, and we'll read about that in just a minute. Let me pause there and see what comments or questions y'all have before we wrap up the story of Samson.
That he may have truly loved Delilah, but she was completely self-absorbed. She had, we see no remorse from her actions and what they did to him, apparently in front of her, gouging his eyes out. And we have all seen individuals who have been in a one-sided relationship, and it's very difficult to deal through that.
Yeah, good one. Thank you. What else? We got both Shaws. JR first.
It's interesting and sad at the same time because it's like Samson never really seems to have that much of a connection to his brethren. He seems to be continuing to go over to the Philistines and just whoever, knowing that they were told not to intermarry and mix with those people, and you see how just kind of gradually he just gets worse and worse.
Yeah.
And even in the things he does to the Philistines that were so brutal.
Right.
It's like he doesn't get it.
Yeah. Only reference to his family is, you know, his parents finding out about his birth and then helping to arrange his marriage, and then after he's dead, them coming to get his body and taking it back to their hometown. JR?
Maybe this doesn't apply, well, feel free to say that, but it seems like, you know, Samson, when he was dealing with maybe the threats directly, the big threats that he would perceive, he seemed to have done pretty good. But when it comes to something more subtle, he's a big, strong guy. He's carried off gates. He's killed all these men with, you know, the jaw of a donkey and all this mess. But then something like a woman, he doesn't think he's going to fall to that. I don't think he thought he was going to fall. But that was still, I think, sinful, and it was something he underestimated, the power of sin, no matter how it's presented. And then he kept flirting with it. And over that time of that, he falls. And I think it, for us, it's the subtlety of sin. We don't, well, I can handle that. I can handle that sin. I can handle being in bad company. I can handle whatever. And that's just, that's what I take away from it. Don't get around that. Do what you were talking about earlier. Be around our brethren and listen to them when they tell you, hey, something looks like it's maybe going astray here.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Thanks. All right, back in Gaza, the city. Samson's in prison, and the Philistines put Samson to hard labor of grinding. During this time, the author notes Samson's hair begins to grow, and this may be a hint that with the return of his long hair, Samson's strength would return too. So in Gaza now, the Philistines are throwing a big shindig. They're honoring Dagon, their god, for delivering Samson over to them, or so they think. Of course, it was the Lord that had allowed Samson to be taken captive by the Philistines, and we learn from verse 27 that there are thousands gathered at this event. So verse 27 just tells us how many people were on the roof. That was 3,000, but then there are also the Philistine lords, prominent Philistines at this gathering as well. This appears to have taken place in a Philistine temple. The word in Hebrew used for this structure is often translated house, as it may be in your version, but word is also used to refer to religious structures, like in Judges chapter 18 and verse 31 that we'll study next week, that being Micah's carved image that he made. So a temple would have been a natural location for this kind of celebration that took place in this context, and it's filled with the elite of the Philistines, again with these 3,000 onlookers on the roof, putting, as you can imagine, considerable strain on the structure of the building. They praise Samson for having handed over they praise their god Dagon for having handed over Samson to them and called him the ravager of their country who had multiplied their slain. At the height of their festivities, probably when most people were the drunkest, they asked for Samson to entertain them. So he's called out of prison, put between two pillars of the house or temple, and forced to entertain them. Samson at this point asks a young man who has assisted him, because he's blind, to allow him to touch the pillars that support the structure. What I think is really neat is that this is not in Gaza, but this is an example of a Philistine temple that's been excavated, and here are what? Two pillars. And this is a proposed layout of that Philistine temple, and there are several temples from this period that follow a very similar layout with these two central pillars. So, between these two pillars, Samson cries out to God. He asks to be remembered and strengthened just one more time, expressing his desire to be avenged on the Philistines for blinding him. That's what he says in verse 28, is why he wants to cause this great calamity that's about to happen. He takes hold of these two pillars that support the structure, leaned against them, and says with his dying words in verse 30, "Let me die with the Philistines." So here, Samson demonstrates a measure of faith, does he not, by calling upon God and believing that God could and would help him. But I take issue with the fact that God's desired intervention was more for personal revenge because they had gouged out his eyes than for the protection of God's people. With all his strength, Samson pushes on the pillars, breaking them and causing the structure to fall on all those who were inside. He dies too. And in this act kills more Philistines than he had in his life. That's the natural reading of it, that in this act he killed more than he had previously in his life. But there's another way to understand the phrase "more than" in this verse, and it's a comparative of importance. That is, those who he killed on this occasion were of greater importance than all the other Philistines that he had killed prior. So he really dealt a big blow to them. So I don't know which is the truth, but in his last act, Samson, again, deals a great blow to the Philistines. As I mentioned before, his family comes to Gaza, takes his body back for burial in the tomb of his father between Zorah and Eshtaol, back where his story began those years before. He had judged Israel for 20 years. That brings us to the end of Samson's story, and we have about 15 minutes left in the class for chapter 17. Which I hope is more than enough time, but I want to pause here and see if anybody has a question or comment about Samson before we go on, or any other takeaways that y'all have from his life. If not, that's okay. All right, here we are, last part, the depths of Israel's apostasy. So, having finished the bulk of the narrative detailing the work of various judges, the Holy Spirit, through the author, is now going to describe how low Israel had sunk. These last five chapters entail two prolonged accounts. The first one will begin tonight. It's in chapter 17 and 18, and it deals with the religious depravity and complete opposition to God's express will that he had over and over told them in his law and in his covenant. That is, the religious corruption of a household, a Levite, and then, as we'll talk about next week, an entire tribe being that of the Danites. The second account, which will take the last three chapters, shows grave moral depravity and its fallout, ending in the book, culminating in a civil war. So there's a shift from parts one and two to part three in that instead of viewing events nationally and God's rescue of his people through these judge deliverers, now to viewing the lives of ordinary people. Now it seems like the author of Judges is just saying, this is what life looked like in Israel around this time. And we'll see again how far they had strayed from their faithfulness to God. Interestingly, there are a couple of references which lead some to believe that the events in these last chapters aren't the last events chronologically in the book of Judges. Because there's a reference to grandsons of Moses in chapter 18 and verse 30, and a grandson of Aaron in chapter 20, verse 27. So if that's true, then these chapters seem to be connected to the period immediately following the death of Joshua. In other words, happening after the first couple of chapters, and just showing us, if that's true, how quickly Israel sank into this depravity that we'll read about in just a moment. We're now introduced in verse 1 of chapter 17 to Micah. Micah is a shortened version of the Hebrew name Micah-Yehu. That name means "who is like Yahweh." Of course, ironic given the fact that Micah created his own religious system that we'll read about in just a moment. So Micah's first interaction that we read about is one with his mother. So his mother apparently had invoked a curse upon the guilty party who had stolen 1,100 pieces of silver from her. By the way, where have we heard that number before, 1,100 pieces of silver? Wyatt? Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So again, I don't know. I'm just saying. The number's the same. Instead of reacting, so he tells her, "I'm the one who stole the money." Okay. So instead of reacting with anger or following through on the curse that she had pronounced, she says what? blessed be my son by the Lord. Or the NET says, may the Lord reward you, my son. Isn't that twisted? Isn't that topsy-turvy? So he returns the silver pieces to his mother, and she dedicates it to the Lord, and then either gives it back to her son for him to facilitate the construction or making of a carved image or a metal image, or just gives it directly to the silversmith. So if this amount of silver, 1,100 pieces, it's about 24 pounds, and in today's money is estimated about $25,000. Again, just as a review, Exodus 20 and verse 4, you shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. And part of what she said, either I solemnly consecrate the money that came back to her, it could also be translated as I fully consecrate. So did she take the full amount of what she was given back and dedicate it to the Lord, or did she take part of it? She took part of it. So she only took 200 pieces of silver. So if that's the case of what she originally intended, I fully consecrate the full amount, her decision to only give these 200 shekels of silver to the silversmith suggests that she does not follow through on her pledge. So this story reveals that the worship of God obviously, in contrast to God's will, the worship of God must be conducted through appropriate means at the appropriate place, which is a major focus of Deuteronomy, which is not happening here. That's what would have really stood out to the audience, initial audience of Judges. So she takes the 200 pieces of silver that her son had restored and gives it to a silversmith who made, per her wish, a carved image and a metal image, and they remained in Micah's house. We're also told that he had a shrine and an ephod. Where have we seen an ephod before in this book? Yep, that's right, Gideon. So that's what was part of Gideon's apostasy, if you want to look at it that way, as well as Israel's apostasy at the end of Gideon's life. So remember, this was a priestly vestment or garment that may have been worn by Micah's priest, who was initially who? Who did he first hire to be his own personal priest? His son, okay. So Micah was of what tribe? Ephraim, and was a priest from Ephraim authorized by God? No, absolutely not. Only from the tribe of Levi. So again, we have Micah here straying in several ways from God's will. So this idol, made from stolen money as potentially only a partial fulfillment of an abhorrent vow made to God by a woman who first cursed and then blessed the culprit, is then placed in Micah's house. So again, you can just see how backwards everything was during this time. And now for the first time, we read in verse 6, in those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So just again, depicting what life was like during this period of the judges. We talked about this during our introduction class, that phrase, in those days, there was no king, was likely a historical reference for the initial and future audiences of judges, just helping people understand where Israel was during this time. Israel, of course, should have honored their king, Jehovah, and followed his law and reaped the blessings. But as we see in the entire book of Judges, they did not do that. But the phrase may also point to a place for godly leadership in the nation of Israel, which in this stage should have been fulfilled by godly judges. And in the next stage of Israel's history, should have been fulfilled by godly kings, but sadly wasn't then either. God, of course, had given his law to the Israelites and repeatedly encouraged them to follow it faithfully. He had also repeatedly warned them of the consequences of not following his law and the punishment that they would face because of that. They refused to honor God and follow his law and instead chose to do what pleased themselves. And that's seen here in a religious context by what Micah is doing with his idols and his priest. Are we effectively leaderless today? Doing what's right in our own eyes by not submitting to our king and just doing whatever pleases us? We can be. So now we're going to move on to, for the last couple of minutes, just this last few verses of chapter 17. And in these verses, we're going to see a Levite introduced into the story, a nameless young man residing in Bethlehem. He was a Levite. And the fact that he's called a young man may indicate that he was of the age not yet eligible to serve as a priest. We don't know that for a fact, but there were guidelines that a man had to be a certain age in order to function as a priest. So that we're told here he was young, may just further lend itself to the fact that he wasn't even following God's will in terms of that. So he's from Bethlehem, and he's going to, so Bethlehem is here, and he's going to wander up into the hill country of Ephraim where Micah and his shrine and idols and his son serving as priest are located. Upon meeting Micah, he asks the young Levite, "Where do you come from?" At this time, remember, Micah had made his own son a priest. After finding out that the young man is a Levite, Micah makes him an offer. He says to him that he could stay with him and serve as both his father and priest. And so that role of father is a title of honor, suggesting the priest would give advice and protect the interest of the family. So he's both father and priest. In addition to lodging, the Levite would receive a salary, being 10 pieces of silver per year, plus clothes and food. Does the young man take the offer? He does. He agrees. Having this Levite, priest. About that, would God have prospered Micah as a lead made? Of course not. This account is as close-made religion as there is. Micah had a shrine, idols, first his son serving as priest, and then to lend more legitimacy to his enterprise, he now hires a Levite as priest. And he's deluded in thinking that God would bless him in these efforts, as all are who concoct their own way of serving God instead of following his will. So Micah and the Levite story is not over. We're going to read about them in the next chapter, which will be in our next class. But that brings me to the end of my material for this class. So I just want to pause there and see what y'all have on chapter 17.
Jerry. You were talking about what it meant for him to be a father.
So different from a priest, it's likely that Micah meant that this young Levite would divine God's will in matters, maybe even using the ephod. Joseph, in one instance in Genesis chapter 45 and verse 8, was called a father to Pharaoh because he divined his dreams and interpreted them for him. And so not necessarily just a priest, but also a spiritual advisor, essentially in charge. He put him in charge of his house, as far as I understand. Wyatt?
There in chapter 16, I think, how much did you say that the Israelites would have as normal salary or whatever it was?
I think it was 22 shekels a year.
Roughly what for us?
So for us, well, I know 1,100 was $25,000. So it's been a long day. I can't do whatever that is. I don't know, $100? I'll do the math and get back to you. Did you have a, yeah, go ahead. Okay, yeah, that sounds more than right. Yeah. I have a calculator at work, so don't worry that I'm just like making up numbers at work. All right. So our takeaway for tonight, Samson was strong and heroic, but lacked an essential characteristic that ultimately led to his downfall, and that is self-control. In his case, his bane was lust for women, and he was driven by that lust and also revenge to his demise. What can we learn from that? Well, for us, if we don't keep our desires in control and exercise self-control, we will go down the same deadly road that Samson was on. They will separate us from God, and I'm talking about the kind of desires, not exactly like Samson had, but similar to what he had, if not exactly the same. They will leave a damaging wake in our path, meaning that it's not just going to take us down, but we're going to leave a whole lot of people affected by it as well, negatively. And so like Samson, we may do some good. You know, he was a judge. He had faith. He battled against the Philistines. But as I made the point last week, it was nowhere near his potential, what he could have done for Israel, and neither will we live up to our potential when we fail to exercise self-control in our lives. So that brings us to the end of class for tonight. Thank you all very much for your participation, and we'll see you next week.